This is a Vantage House production.
Hi folks, welcome back. There is a cataclysmic situation in Haiti right now, and I want to talk about it. I'm Chaylin, and this is The Delve. We start today's episode focusing on the Caribbean nation of Haiti. 2.5 years ago, The Delve covered the fallout from the assassination of former President Jovenel Moïse. Since then, the situation has only become more dire. And this is not some tiny, dispensable place. Haiti is the third largest country in the Caribbean, and with a population of 11.4 million, it's the most populous. A New York Times article published last week said gang violence has killed more than 1,500 people in Haiti so far this year. The United Nations Human Rights Office described it as a cataclysmic situation in the country. Corruption, impunity, and poor governance, together with increasing levels of gang violence, have brought the Caribbean nation's state institutions close to collapse, the agency said. Since the Haitian Revolution, which happened from 1791 to 1804, Haiti has had it pretty rough. Sure, Haiti became the world's first black-led republic and the first independent Caribbean state. Haiti also became the first nation in the Americas to ban slavery in the early 1800s. But all of this came with a literal price. Haiti was forced to pay back reparations to its colonizer, France. France demanded Haiti compensate for former French slaveholders and their descendants. This debt, about $21 billion, wasn't paid off until 1947. Imagine where Haiti would be today if they had been able to invest that $21 billion over these past two centuries. Haiti has gone from being one of the world's richest colonies, once known as the Pearl of the Antilles, to a state on the brink, with no remaining elected government officials. The question is, where do we go from here? To answer that question, I'm joined by our guest today, Mikolvi J. Neal, the executive editor of the Haitian Times. Let's get into it.
Okay, Mac, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on to The Delve.
How are you today? I'm doing great. Thank you, Taylor, for this opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to get this started asking, can you tell us about yourself and what the Haitian Times is all about?
Sure. So the Haitian Times was founded in 1999 here in Brooklyn, where I live and have lived for some 30 so odd years. And the story of the Haitian Times is pretty close and personal and mirrors sort of like my story, right? So. I'll start with like my journey a little bit. My family moved to the U.S. when I was 10 years old, and we lived in Brooklyn, which is a traditional Haitian enclave, right, in New York City. And growing up here, it was rough, right? It's the early 90s. Things are tough all around. And, you know, kids get picked on. You learn to stick with your own kind, if you will, even within the Black community where we live, right? And a lot of our news that I consume, my family consumed, came to us through Creole speaking radio, a lot of pirate radio in New York all around. And the newspapers were in French and they were in black and white. So if you're growing up here in New York City over time, you're looking at the newsstands and you see the Daily News, the New York Times, the New York Post, and newsstands were very, very colorful at the time. I was always very curious, reading newspapers. I was part of like this program at school that was sort of like a journalism in schools type of education initiative. So I grew up reading newspapers in French, Creole radio primarily, and then New York-centric publications. So by the time I was getting ready to go to college, and started to really get the journalism bug and the storytelling bug, I was feeling like the stories that interested me, that I was closest to, I didn't really see them in this landscape that I mentioned, right? Nothing really was documenting my experience as a Haitian American or generation, you know, 1.5, growing up here, assimilating, trying to figure it out, living in two worlds, if you will, like Haitian household and then U.S. outside of my house, right? In school and whatnot. Right. And so that's kind of where, around college, is where the Haitian Times and I kind of met. I was figuring out if I was going to go into corporate communications or pursue journalism in school. And for an internship, right, my internship requirement, I needed to spend time at an actual newsroom. And that's when I stumbled on the Haitian Times. Either my father brought it home one day, the actual, you know, paper. I think that's how I learned about it. It just fell into my hands. And I remember being like, oh my God, it's a newspaper for Haitians, about Haitians in English, you know, where I can fully understand what's going on. And it's talking about not just what's happening in Haiti, but also what's going on here in the US. This is amazing. So of course, I wrote up with a quick thing with an email at the time, right? Say, I'm looking for an internship, you know, give me one. And I was ignored again. And then finally, Gary Pierre responded and said, okay, you can come in for an interview. And I went in and he was just like, I knew I would hire you. This was a test because I wanted to see how persistent you were, because journalists have to be persistent. I was like, okay, sure. Why not? I ended up saying not just for my internship, but for 3 years after college. I stayed another like 2.5 to 3 years before moving on to the Sun Sentinel in Fort Lauderdale. But those 3 years were really pivotal for me because it really allowed me to dig really deep into my own community and find out about different facets of Haiti, Haitian life, you know, Haitians that I just wasn't privy to living in my household and being from where I'm from in Haiti. We just didn't get that level of connection, being from different places, different classes, different religions and all of that. And the Haitian Times allowed me to be exposed to different ways that Haitians live and experience life in Haiti and in the US and in between, right? And so that idea of bridging the gap has really resonated with me. And it's why after being in journalism for some 7 years or so, I did end up making the switch to corporate communications for a while. But during COVID, that sense of I don't see us reflected in the news as COVID was hitting all these communities, I wasn't seeing a lot of patients in the picture, right? And that's how I made my way back to contributing stories initially, here and there, about how, you know, folks were dying in the community. This was early on when people were still wondering if this was a hoax, if it was real, right before lockdown. And because of the Haitian Times, I was able to make sure my community showed up in the narrative, right? And that's why I've stayed again over the past 3 years and went from contributing stories to being managing editor and executive editor, dealing with everything from launching boot camps in Haiti, so we have correspondents there, getting a roster of freelancers across the U.S. put together so we can call on different people to help us tell those stories here in the U.S., and then obviously being that connector, if you will, that's helping us all to fill the gap between what's happening in Haiti and what's happening here in the U.S., not just from the Haitian lens, but from the context of everything else going on around the world geopolitically.
I think that's like a really interesting arc to have started as like an intern and, you know, all these years later to be the executive editor. That's awesome. I love that. What is some of the passion that is behind the stories you cover? I know you were saying that you want to create, it's an interesting thing to have the Haitian Times have like a place for you and your people and your country. But what's some of the passion that drives that?
A lot of it is really a quest to like humanize Haiti and Haitians. in the narratives that we see out there about Haiti, right? It's so easy to just see like a mass of black bodies at the land border, right? Or to see boats at sea, like rocking and swaying and being pulled out of the ocean, right? Or even in Haiti right now, as we speak, these gangsters, you know, quote unquote, walking around with baklavas and, you know, machine guns and just looking really scary, right? Just looking like demons. And so that's not the Haiti that I grew up in or that I have experienced. And so that lack of context is missing in so much of the overarching stories and narratives we have about Haiti. So a lot of that is at the Haitian Times is bringing people the stories out of Haiti or about Haiti that you won't really see anywhere else, certainly not in mainstream media, because one, that's not their role, right? They have a broader audience. Some of them are international, not just national, and they're looking at Haiti from the standpoint of what's in it for us, you know? Why should we care? Why should we get involved? And you'll see this in editorials on Fox News and all of that, right? We're trying to tell the other side of the story that Haitians know, the Haiti that we know and love, and the reason that we're so hopeful and that we fight so much for this country to continue to exist despite everything that it's gone through since before 1804, right? Before independence. Yeah. So it's that drive to show us as people, as human beings who are going through difficulties, challenges, certainly socially, politically, economically, and not just relegate us, right? To these people who can't get their acts together and that the world should just give up on.
No pressure, but can you walk us through what has happened since October 2021?
Oh my God. So, yeah. I'm going to try, and I'm going to try to hit...
I'll help you out where I can, but this is mainly a you project.
Milestones, right? And you can cut whichever you want. So, last Haiti was attuned to the world. The president had been assassinated in July 2021. We had an earthquake in August 2021 that killed 2,000 people. And then we had thousands of Haitians who immigrated from Latin Central America and were at the Del Rio encampment trying to gain asylum into the U.S., right? The Del Rio fiasco, as we refer to it here. Since then, Haiti has continuously fallen in decline politically. Because where we had an interim prime minister, Ariel Henry, take office after the assassination, his role at the time was to set up elections and help Haiti move to a peaceful transition, right? His stated goal from July, August 2021 was, I'm here to make sure we have elections. Over the next year, that never came to pass. What we did see were a series of transitional government proposals that came forward, specifically one from a coalition of organizations in Haiti that referred to itself as the Montana Agreement or the Montana Accord, named after the hotel where they met to come up with their proposal for a transition government. So the Montana Accord, for all intents and purposes, is came out of that 2021-2022 era. It never went anywhere for a variety of reasons. One of them being that the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, couldn't agree on what they were proposing. And one of their key requirements was that Ariel Henry resign and hand over the Prime Minister role to someone of their choosing because they were appointing their own president. In between that time, we had another series of proposals that came forward. One of them was out of a university here in Louisiana. So it went by the Louisiana Summit. Also didn't go anywhere. all this time, we had advocates come forward saying the United States really should support the Montana Agreement because it's the most cohesive, the one that had the most traction, and that included folks that the United States is already familiar with because the State Department has dossiers on all of those people who were involved. Those are words of Daniel Foote, the former special envoy who ended up resigning over the Del Rio debacle, right? While all of this political intrigue and theater is going on, Haiti lost its opportunity to hold elections and appoint deputies, senators, regional heads to actually make sure the country was functioning and had things like healthcare, potable water, you know, education, all of that stuff. Even worse, the gangs that had always existed to do the bidding of quite a few of these folks who were involved in the political sector, the private sector, the money class, as we call them, the oligarchs, right? They started seeing an opportunity to just take different territories all around the capital so that when elections did eventually happen, they could deliver different precincts to whoever the highest bidder was, right? It's historically, I have to take a little tangent here. Historically, the gangs in Haiti, or you might call them, they've gone by different names over the years, right? Right now we're calling them gangs, but they're really part of an organized crime unit, if you will, that are deployed by whoever is paying them to do their bidding. And we've seen versions of these gangs show up throughout different administrations in Haiti, going as far back as the Tonton Macoutes that Duvalier had in the 60s and 70s that he used as tools to remain in power, to repress people, right? It's the same model under different names. So here we are in 2022, 2023. The gangs are saying, they're hearing elections are coming, so we need to move forward with having different territories we can control to deliver different votes, right? And so they're paid by people who have these interests, from what we've heard, to, you know, deliver these precincts and force people to vote their way. That's when we started hearing a lot about not just the shootings, the neighborhood takeovers, but also the kidnappings, right? Kidnappings skyrocketed between 2022 and 2023 in Haiti because these gangs started controlling not just specific landmarks or territory in Haiti, but they started taking over access of the roads, like in and out of the city. Okay, they started taking over the ports, for example, where goods were being shipped in and out of the country, mostly in. Among those goods, small arms, right? But arms smuggling is, again, another story we'll get to. So then they just, I guess, didn't see the need to really have a middleman, right, an intermediary, and they started making demands on their own. So when they took over the port by October 2022, the main port in Haiti, Ariel Henry found himself in a bind, really. Because here he is, he hasn't delivered elections, the various agreements haven't gone anywhere, the gangs are taking over, access to water is blocked by the gangs controlling different roads. And so he raised his hand and begged the international community to send in an armed force to help fight
the gangs. Okay, and this is where it's getting exciting, because I'm guessing this is kind of where Kenya comes onto the scene.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
It took a while, right? At the end of 2022, October 2022 is when Ariel Henry first said, you know, please help. I can't handle this by myself anymore. No one is listening to me. It took another series of meetings, diplomatic, you know, formal and informal meetings in Latin America, in Europe, in Canada, in the US, for Kenya to eventually raise its hand in the summer of 2023 to say, okay, we're willing to lead this force, right?
I want to jump in for a second. Kenya seems so random. Is there some type of relationship between Haiti and Kenya, or are they just like, okay, we'll do it?
Haiti and Kenya have not had a relationship.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
whatsoever.
And they don't speak the same language. Like, no. They're sending this Kenyan police force. It's so strange.
Yeah, it's not even West Africa, where you might argue that, you know, historically, West Africa is where a lot of Haitians have had their ancestry tied to. Sure. Like, you look the same. Like, but yeah. We had this deal that was struck in the UN where the deal was, if you take this on, the rest of the international community, led by the US, Canada, would contribute the $600 million or so it would take to meet this force, and Kenya would manage this, and Kenya would get a percentage of this money for, you know, lending its troops and taking on the lead, right? Mind you, in between all this happening at the diplomatic level, right, Haiti in January 2023 lost the last remaining members of its parliament that had been elected going back to 2017 for their 6-year term. So between 2021, the assassination, and January 2023, the country lost every elected member, either through, you know, killings, kidnapping, and certainly because of the lack of elections, they were never held, the entire government. So it fell literally into a vacuum. And we ended up with Ariel Henry being the sole person who was the face of the government, but who was never legitimately elected, and who really outlasted his tenure to hold elections. But entreaties to the U.S.
I don't know if people can, like, grasp that. That there is no elected official in government. There is just a person, unelected.
Yes.
Everyone else has either been killed, died, or their terms ended.
Yes.
And there's now this one guy. It's like, it's so hard to grasp. It's like all of U.S. Congress gone.
That's right.
They're gone. There's no vice president. There's no president. There's just maybe a Speaker of the House who was appointed but not elected. And they're just trying to make rules.
Right. And even the Supreme Court. This is funny. The person who would have been the default leader of the country or head of government, you know, after assassination, the head of the coup de cassation, he died. I think Jenny spoke about this before. Oh, he died like 2 weeks before the assassination.
Oh my God.
COVID, right? So literally no vacuum. And so that was part of the reasoning, the rationale for the US and other friends of Haiti, quote unquote, to say, well, you know, Ariel Henry is the only one we have to stick by him, right?
Yeah.
But it seems like that went on for far too long because there was no immediacy. Like, the world lost the urgency to get Haiti into a functioning place after we turned off the cameras, right? Or I should say mainstream media turned off the cameras and went away. And so it just continued to decline into what we have today with the gangs taking over and there being no elected officials whatsoever in the country.
Are there governors, mayors?
There are mayors. There are local officials, right? Some of these local town officials, local police, government commissioners, local police, how would I call them? Like deputy heads of police had figured out how to function without protocols to a certain extent, right? Like, they still depended on some funding for things, but for all intents and purposes, they've been running their own little, you know, fiefdoms, if you will. They couldn't rely on protocols for much, okay? The rest of the country also relied a lot on local grassroots organizations who would come in and help farmers set up agricultural cooperatives, right? Who would organize medical missions, you know, healthcare missions with using their relationships with people in the diaspora, for example. We would organize someone from your church or your own hospital to take use equipment to Haiti, do vision screening, cancer screenings, all of those, right? So the rest of the population had kind of figured out how to basically be self-sustaining. But the problem is that that's only global for so long, you know? So now we're seeing a case of people leaving Port-au-Prince with this latest assault by the gangs that we'll get to. They're now, you know, going back to their ancestral homes in the provinces and kind of going through this forced, like, reverse migration just to escape with their lives. But there are still big questions to address about how they're actually going to maintain livelihoods in these places that weren't really set up to accommodate large influxes of people coming in, and where you still need the government to build roads, pay teachers, you know, give you access to potable water. Like, all of these things are still major infrastructure projects that need to happen, that, yes, you might get lucky and have a local group or committee set up, as we've seen with the Wanamet Canal at the border that Haiti shares with the Dominican Republic. But the question is, you know, how much longer is it going to be sustainable when you don't have government involved? You know, how many more donations can you get from the diaspora and people who are supporting you right now to build it versus maintaining it and keeping it operational or expanding it? See?
I want to jump a little bit ahead to this new presidential council, this transitional presidential council. So Henri is on this mission in Kenya to secure this force. He can't get back into the country. Mm-hmm. The gangs have overtaken the airport in Port-au-Prince. They're like, no, there's no way you're getting in. He tries to land in DR. They refuse his plane, which to me sounds insane. He has to go to Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah, I just can't even. He has to go to Puerto Rico.
Right.
He's basically like a government in exile in Puerto Rico, trying to run things in Haiti. I'm Puerto Rican, so I was like really intrigued by this. And then CARICOM, the regional kind of like economic group, comes in and they're like trying to figure out how they can help. I guess this transitional presidential council has been in the works for some time, and there's just like this extra urgency to get it done now. And then Henri says, I'll resign once this council is up and running. Mm-hmm. And my, oh my, how fast that council gets up and running.
Oh my God. Yes and no, right?
Okay. Okay. Help me out here.
So, CARICOM, right? The Caribbean community is what CARICOM stands for. It's a regional, like, economic bloc, right? It's a trading bloc, kind of like the EU, European Union, acts, you know, for Europe. And so they've actually been involved for some time in this Haiti transition. In fact, when Kenya said, okay, we'll lead the force around the same time at the United Nations, around the summer of 2023, spring 2023, is where CARICOM came on the scene, said, okay, Kenya's going to lead the force. We'll work with our Haitian brothers and sisters who are going back and forth with all these different agreements to get them to come to a consensus, right? So they had this thing in Kingston and all these other cities in the Caribbean to try to get the Haitians to agree to some sort of power sharing agreement or transition, right? It didn't happen. And so this is where, for me, it like really gets me that it didn't happen when we had the opportunity back in July 2023. And we waited until we had the gangs take over the capital this year to get serious about it, right? This is where I blame a lot of these people who were involved in the agreements from the get-go, who were just like, no, it's, you know, Ariel Henry has to go, or no deal whatsoever. And it's just really highlights how folks are just out for their self-interest until they know they don't have a choice anymore and they're back into a corner. They were never really about Haiti having the best chance to move forward, is what this is to me. So CARICOM, all throughout 2023, held at least 5 meetings in Haiti and at least 2 more outside of Haiti to try to get Ariel Henry to sit down with, you know, Petite Dessalines, the Fleming Lavalas party, the Montana Accord people that I mentioned earlier, right? Nothing. So Jimmy Cherizier, you know, as Barbecue, and other gangs who had been fighting each other all this time, right? They see that ILRE is in Kenya really signing off on this deal to bring this force and down.
Do they kind of see it as their chance?
Yeah, they see it as their chance. Because all this time they had been saying, you know, you need to address our issues and what we've been fighting for, right? Between the time that Jovenel Moïse was killed and 2023, a lot of these gang members started to position themselves as so-called revolutionaries who are just out to basically like modern day Robin Hood, right? Who are kidnapping and stealing from the haves to give to the have-nots, right? Never mind all the senseless killings that happen, you know? Okay, so that's the story they want to go with, and we're just watching this. They decide, well, it looks like it's really going to happen. Now's our chance. Cherizier decides to engineer this alliance with some of the other powerful gangs all across Port-au-Prince, of which some 300 at this point, right? And they keep growing and growing and spreading out more.
That's wild.
Yeah, within this 20-mile radius I'm talking about, right? It's 20 miles. Yeah, so they're like, okay, if this force is really coming down, now's our chance. Let's get together. They form what's called the Vivre Ensemble Alliance, you know? Living together, you know? And so they're responsible for the mass prison break that happened because they wanted to show that they wanted to have a say. Until this day, no one is still talking with the gangs about coming to the table or bringing them into the process, right? A lot of the CPC stuff, the discussions are essentially ignoring the gangs question. And their idea is, okay, the gangs have taken over the capital because they don't want Kenya to come. Let's form this transitional government. And then that government, after it elects a president and has cabinet members, then that group will figure out how to deal with the
gangs. That's insane.
Meanwhile, we're hearing how the gangs are taking over hospitals and setting up different, like, military stations to fight with the police because they're advancing forward to move into the National Palace, like literally where the president of the country sat before he was assassinated. They've taken over practically everything else, the ports, I mentioned various roads. You know, people can't even leave their house without permission from the local gang to either get an escort or to pay your way out. We literally have people right now in Haiti whose elderly parents can't get out. We have been trying to maintain communication over WhatsApp, hiding under their beds because you don't know when a stray bullet is coming and if it'll be from the gun of a gang member or a police officer. You don't really know, right? So some of the stories we've heard lately, Galen, is like, I never thought it would come to me, to my house, like where I live in Pittsburgh, you know, which is supposed to be this like nicer enclave in the hills and whatnot, right? Like, this wasn't supposed to come all the way up here to get to me, right? And that's the fallacy a lot of patients have to deal with right now, that they thought for whatever reason they had some sort of shield, they could bubble wrap themselves from the gang violence that was all around them. So that's for us to deal with and realize, you know, what happens anywhere in this country really affects everyone else in the country. Just like we've seen in general, what happens with Port-au-Prince, because that's where so much of the power structure of the country is concentrated, does eventually impact the rest of the 10 million people outside in the other departments, right? So, you know, just imagine waking up one day and not knowing if you're going to make it to the next day. Not a car accident, you know, not something random, not a disaster, like a natural phenomenon like this tremor we've had in New York City, you know, but because you don't have a government, calling the police is useless. The police, you know, had been telling people to defend themselves as much as they could, And that's what led to the Wakale movement we saw back in spring 2023 that we didn't get to chat about just yet. But people have had to take up arms to defend themselves. And they've been doing that now for some time because there's literally no one to call on. You can't dial 911, you know? The police force is so weakened right now. It's lost thousands and thousands of officers. Some have just defected. Others have been, you know, killed in raids. It's devastating, you know? Like, we hear reports of the mental anguish that the police are dealing with, you know? The drinking on the job is going on because they're at these positions trying to fight up gangs for days and weeks on end with no support. So when you have a situation like that and you hear that the transitional presidential council, this like group of 9 to 11 people are saying things like, well, we need to establish the government structure and then deal with the gang. It just seems so bizarre and unreal. It's like they're being really foolish.
Are the gangs going to just miraculously be like, oh, we have a president now. Let's back off.
Well, you know, and say what you will about the gangs. Yes, they're ruthless. Yes, they've been behind the 8,000 killings or so and injuries, assaults over the past 2 years in this country. Mm. The country has seen. But there's a kernel of truth to their grievances, okay? That's allowed them to gain this much momentum to get to this point, okay? These gangs are made up primarily of young, disenfranchised people, men, usually, who came up in slums around Port-au-Prince. We don't really have an outlook when it comes to, like, their livelihood or having jobs, you know, being able to afford to go to school, being able to eat something every day. Mm-hmm. And through the reporting the Haitian Times has done over the past couple of years, where we took a look at what was driving this movement of so many young people turning to these criminal organizations, a lot of it came down to not having something to eat or being able to have one meal a day to take to your family and loved ones. So when you have a gang leader come to you and say, if you join us, you'll be able to eat. I'm going to pay you on a weekly basis. Is your quota for kidnappings and what you're supposed to bring into the coffers of our organization. And then they show footage of these gang leaders standing outside distributing money to people in their neighborhoods. If you're starving and you don't see a way out, that could be very appealing, right? Sure. And so the conditions that led to the gangs being formed anyway, both politically and socially, still haven't been addressed. So when these folks, you know, get on their soapboxes and say they're basically revolutionaries that are taking the power from the oligarchs and the corrupt political class, you know, and overturning the government for like this uprising of the poor, the urban poor, basically, there's some kernel of truth to it, even though it's an extreme oversimplification that's not, you know, entirely accurate, and that serves the purposes of these leaders who know there's money involved. There's money to be made here, right? Who are manipulating not only the folks that they need to be the foot soldiers, right? But also the media. There's a lot of media manipulation taking place with them using folks who try to pass themselves off as journalists, right? Content creators, basically, whom they'll allow to see them in action to get clicks, right?
I actually have a question about this a little later, okay. So just you wait. I want to talk a little bit about Haiti's relationship with some of its neighbors. One neighbor in particular that I have at the top of my mind, the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. What's happening here? Why can't everyone get along? Why can't they be friends?
Hi, folks. You just completed part one of this incredible episode. Haiti is going through an exceptionally difficult period right now. And if you're looking for a way to help, I'll list some organizations in the show notes. Thanks to Shiva Asma for research and writing for this episode, and to Aaron, Derek, and Brendan for holding us down on sound. Thank you guys for listening in. We'll be back with part two next week. I'm Jalen. This is The Delve. I'll catch you then.